You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Are you working in a building where detained immigrants are being held? In an article in the current issue of The Nation, Jacqueline Stevens says it's a distinct possibility. In her investigation of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office of State and Local Coordination, ICE for short, Ms. Stevens has discovered that the ICE is operating nearly 200 unmarked detention centers all over the United States, including several in New York City. Ms. Stevens is a political theorist and author of the book States Without Nations, Citizenship for Mortals. She is also associated with the University of California, both in Santa Barbara and in Berkeley, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Is the ICE a separate entity from the Immigration and Naturalization Service?
So the Immigration and Naturalization Service actually no longer exists, and ICE is the successor agency to the portion of Immigration and Naturalization that used to deal with immigration law enforcement. So it used to be that both the administrative and the law enforcement parts were one entity, and then after the inauguration of the Department of Homeland Security, those functions were separated.
So this is part of the Homeland Security.
That's correct.
Do you think that the average American citizen is even aware that it exists?
No, I'm fairly certain that the average American citizen is not aware of that it exists. And that's actually a big problem, because when ICE agents come into communities, people have no idea who they are. Even if they do happen to wear uniforms or jackets that identify themselves with the acronym ICE, people don't know what that means.
Yeah, well, I've seen it mentioned in newspapers every once in a while, though it doesn't seem to get much press coverage. But it's always been a bit unclear as to just what they do. So I guess the press is not doing a good job on this, do you think?
I would appreciate more coverage of what ICE does. To be fair, ICE makes it very difficult to understand its function. It's one of the least transparent government agencies that exist, and it's very, very difficult to get information from them.
You quote a former ICE executive director as saying his organization can make people disappear. What does that mean?
Well, James Pendergraf is the person who's quoted there, and he actually was giving this as a statement to local law enforcement officers last year at an event that was attended by Sernada Reynolds of Amnesty International. And she reported on this in a report called Jailed Without Justice. And she, as I mentioned in the article, was really stunned when she heard him say that. He comes out of law enforcement in North Carolina, where he was basically the Joe Arpaio of, he's a sheriff and showed a lot of initiative in trying to arrest people who were suspected of not having legal status. And ICE, worked with him and elevated him through their federal agency to head what's called the 287G programs nationwide. And the 287G programs are the ones authorized under the 1996 bill. And they deputize local law enforcement and allow them to perform immigration enforcement functions.
So there are so many different arms, it's hard to keep track of who's where.
That's right.
He's no longer at ICE.
Right. He supposedly resigned 2 weeks after that statement. So I don't know if that was causal or if just that was a coincidence.
If there were an ICE detention center in my office building, would it be obvious to anyone who works here?
Probably not. There's, for instance, an ICE office on 26th Street, and if you go in that building, it's not listed on the directory that includes listings of other offices. There's no sign. There's, no information that it's there.
Isn't there one just down the street from us here on Varick Street?
Right.
Do you think people passing by have any idea that building contains a detention center?
No, and actually they could even be confused by the absence of signs for that, since there are signs for other federal agencies in that building. So I noticed recently when I was walking by that there's a sign outside indicating that the Veterans Administration has offices there, that the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services has offices there, but there's no indication that people are being held there.
And if I heard rumors that it was the 12th floor, let's say, could I just go up there?
I don't know. they prohibit access to the detention centers without prior security clearance. And even when one does have prior security clearance, it can be very difficult. I'm actually trying to coordinate a visit right now to the Stewart Detention Center in Stewart County, in Lumpkin, Georgia. And I obtained clearance for this visit in September, but it's not obvious that they're going to allow me. And in fact, the Varick Detention Center has not allowed any press tours ever, according to an ICE agent who coordinates tours for other groups. So they allow other groups of lawyers and immigration judges and even law students to go tour that facility, but they do not allow the press.
So nothing has changed with the change of administration?
Not as far as access to those facilities and, you know, publicity and transparency.
On the other hand, can't it be argued that since there's a risk of terrorism, isn't it best to keep these centers as unnoticeable as possible?
Well, that's an interesting point. First of all, that's not the point that the administration has made in response to what I've written. They've come up with different kinds of responses. One that I found especially amusing was when a local group went to ICE facility in, let's see, where was it? In Grand Junction, Colorado, they'd found the list from they'd found the address from the list that was published in the Nation article. And people, if they're interested in seeing where these facilities are in their own communities, can go to the Nation article online.
Do some of the detention centers that you've located?
Right. I received a list of 186 detention. Sorry, I received a partial list of the 186 ICE subfield offices, and those addresses are available on the Nation website through the article. And in any case, when they went to this site that was listed in their community, they were told that so they found a brown, nondescript building in an industrial section that had no signs indicating it was ICE, no signs indicating it was a government building. And when they asked about that, they were told that it was because of budget cutbacks.
Now, what happens if a member of the family of someone being held in one of these detention centers wants to visit? Are they not allowed to visit either?
Well, first of all, they'd have to know where their relative is. And so that can, you know, that's the biggest obstacle.
And lawyers? Do they know where these places are?
The lawyers know where some of the places are. They don't know where all of the places are. And they certainly don't know where the places are out of their immediate locale. So if they have a client who is picked up, let's say, you know, 1,000 miles from where the lawyer's located, the lawyer would have a very hard time tracking down their client.
My guest is Jacqueline Stevens, whose article, America's Secret ICE Castles, is in the current issue of The Nation. So how do you contact members of ICE? Can you email them? Do you phone them? Can you knock on an office door?
You can try all of those things, and you'll meet with different levels of success depending on the location and the agent involved. So, you know, you could get very lucky and someone happens to pick up a phone and answers your question, or you could just hear, depending on, you know, where you're calling, you could just hear the phone ring. You could get a number that says it's, you know, the response is it's not working. It, you know, just picks up and hangs up. There's a whole range of different kinds of responsiveness. The typical experience is that people call and get a voicemail message, an outgoing voicemail message. They leave a message and no one calls them back. I mean, and that is the, I think that's the typical response.
Have you been able to speak to anybody involved in ICE?
Yes.
So how have you been able to get them?
I've spoken to, and most of the people with whom I speak in ICE are in public affairs, and so they, you know, tend
to
be
your calls.
They answer my calls. It's hit and miss. So, you know, if you keep calling and calling and calling, somebody eventually may answer the phone and may or may not talk to you.
Do you have any sense of how many people are being held in these makeshift detention centers?
Right. So just to be clear, so ICE is really, you know, prickly about calling them detention centers, but they are places where people are being detained. In the nomenclature of the agency, they're called subfield offices. And they're designed for people to be held there for relatively short periods of time.
Do they have beds? Do they
no,
have bathrooms?
They don't have beds. They, from what I understand, they have different levels of services. None of them have beds, showers. They have one toilet that is in typically in this cell, and so there would be no privacy. And there's no monitoring of what their treatment is once they're there, and that leads to abuses in those locations, and I've documented some of those in the article.
You've spoken to some people who have left,
right,
have been held and been released.
That's right.
How long do they tend to be held in these conditions?
So going back to your question before about the numbers, according to ICE, about 910 people each day and about almost 340,000 people a year will go through these offices.
So they're like processing offices.
That's what they're designed for.
Mm-hmm. And, what happens to
the
people?
But the thing is that people are you can be arrested in one place and then brought to a subfield office in one locale, but then end up in several other offices en route to a detention center. You could then be transferred from one detention center to another detention center and then be held in these facilities en route to this other place. When you go into these, I've heard stories about people being stripped.
Who designed this? Did Franz Kafka design this whole thing?
That's one thought. One of the questions I always ask ICE when I'm engaging in this kind of investigation is the name of the person who's supplying the answer. They have never given me the name of the person responsible for giving these answers. And it's very hard to, pin that down. So
they don't want to be quoted.
They don't want to be quoted, and they don't want to be accountable. And I think that that's a huge problem. And it's especially, as you were suggesting earlier, a little alarming in light of the Obama administration's overall commitment to transparency.
So you've spoken to some of the people who have been picked up and held at these unmarked detention centers and then been released.
Mm-hmm.
What did they tell you? That did most of them get shifted from office to office?
Mm-hmm. So one person with whom I've spoken quite extensively is a United States citizen. And I want to mention this because I heard in the run-up to the show that you said that immigrants are being held here. Well, if you have these places that are off the map and that are unaccountable, it's not shocking that you would also be arresting, that you'd also find ICE arresting people who are legally in the country, either as United States citizens or as people who are legal residents and whose record would not be consistent with being deported. And so Mark Little was born in North Carolina. And it is absolutely illegal for ICE to detain U.S. citizens.
And why was he picked up?
So he was actually, and this is how a lot of United States citizens end up in these facilities. He was serving a short jail sentence at a nearby facility, and through racial profiling was incorrectly identified as being born in Mexico. And then through a series of misunderstandings, signed some documents, and he has some mental challenges. And even after he expressed his comprehension of the situation and asserted that he was a U.S. citizen, he nonetheless was continued pushed through this process. He was held at the Cary office, in the ICE subfield office in Cary, and he told the agents there, "I'm a United States citizen. I was born in Rowan County, North Carolina. Call my mother, call my brothers. You can check this out." His FBI record, which is in their database, which they pulled up, indicates that he's a United States citizen in several places. It gives his social security number, and it says that he was born in the United States. Based on that information, he never should have been pushed through the deportation process, which is what happened, and he ultimately was deported to Mexico.
They deported him to Mexico.
That's
they didn't
correct.
Just release him. So then he could come back because he was an American citizen?
So he tried coming back twice at the border in Hidalgo in Texas. And because of this deportation, they would not allow him back into the country. And they, in fact, threatened him with prison time if he persisted in trying to return to the United States.
And so now he's in Mexico?
So from Mexico, he was sent to Honduras because he's not Mexican. And from Honduras, he was put in jail. And after local inmates in the jail reported on this, outrageous event to the local news media, Honduras shuffled him through Nicaragua and El Salvador. He ended up in Guatemala, and presented himself to the U.S. consulate in Guatemala. I actually interviewed the person with whom he spoke, and she was very upset because to her, his situation was really straightforward. As you know, somebody who's familiar with trying to ascertain citizenship status, she told me that his was an easy case, and she just contacted his family, and within a day, they had issued him a U.S. passport.
So he's back in the United States. But I hope he spoke some Spanish because
didn't speak a word of Spanish.
My guest is Jacqueline Stevens, whose article America's Secret Ice Castles is in the current issue of The Nation. She is the author of States Without Nations, Citizenship for Mortals, which is published by Columbia University Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jacqueline Stevens, whose article, America's Secret Ice Castles, is in the current issue of The Nation. Haven't several civil rights organizations filed lawsuits against the ICE regarding secret detention centers?
As far as I know, there's been no lawsuit about the secret detention, about people being held in secret per se. There has been a lawsuit about the conditions in one of these facilities, and it's called B18, which is a office in a corner of a federal building in Los Angeles. And the Southern California ACLU and some other civil rights groups filed a lawsuit last spring against the Obama administration because people were being held there in the supposedly temporary facility for weeks and perhaps months on end. This facility did not have any showers. It didn't have any access to legal materials. It didn't have two toilets, one of which was stopped up, and the whole room smelled. People were being shuffled back and forth from this facility, not to a detention center, but to jails overnight, and then brought back.
A listener asks, would you say that the ICE system is malevolent or just seriously disorganized?
Yes.
To both?
Yes.
But to some degree, this is also a punitive thing. We picked you up, and we're going to make you as miserable as possible?
There is that part to it, and it works as a means of coercing people to sign documents relinquishing their right to legal claims to remain in the United States. And that is a persistent pattern that I've seen across the detention centers and throughout the immigration process, law enforcement process.
Well, John from the Lower East Side asks if you think that this has gotten out of hand since illegal immigrant situation is so out of hand as it is and ICE is overwhelmed.
No, I don't think that that's what's going on. There aren't appreciably more people who don't have legal status here now than at any other point. And if anything, I would turn it around and say that it is the enforcement of these laws that are pretty much illogical and in some ways immoral that lead to these kinds of crazy outcomes. If you're trying to enforce a system of laws that regulate people's movement, and have no basis on their family ties or their work aspirations or their other kinds of intimate relationships, you're going to end up with the kind of system that we have. One of the things I talk about in my book are earlier efforts to restrict movement within particular countries in, say, the 16th and 17th century. If you were caught outside of your parish of birth without a pass, you would be severely punished. You could have your ear burned. You could be killed. And thousands of people were killed in the 16th and 17th century when they were caught outside of their place of origin without having any kind of documentation, which you couldn't get if you were a normal person during that period.
This was attempts by local governments to control population movements, keep cities small.
That's exactly right.
We still see that today, or we did during the Soviet Union, to some degree also in China, where people have to get special permission to move to cities.
That's right. And the anxiety is the same one that is generated over the more general kind of question of movement across borders, which is that if you allow free movement, the hordes are all going to flood into the more wealthy areas and it'll be a disaster. And if you had in the 17th century said, no, you know, that's an irrational fear, that won't happen, people would have the same response to you then. that people have now when there's a suggestion that perhaps we should have free movement. If you look, for instance, at New York City, where we have about one-third of the population foreign-born, we don't have the kinds of chaos and disorder and lowering of the quality of life that people claim would happen if we had free movement.
A listener wonders whether, in terms of American citizens getting arrested, isn't it more likely for naturalized citizens versus American-born citizens to get picked up and deported?
Yeah, it is more likely, and that's because the burden of proof is on the government once you assert birth in the United States. It's the burden of proof is on the government to show that you are not a U.S. citizen if you assert birth in the United States. That's something that generally naturalized citizens wouldn't have. The other category of people who get targeted for this kind of illegal detention and deportation are people who are U.S. citizens by birth, but they were born outside the country.
We have a caller who was picked up by ICE and detained for 2 weeks. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. What happened?
Well, I've been here in the United States for over 36 years. When first year I came to this country, I got an incident with the police, but this was in court. Well, the record's supposed to be expunged and it's gone away. After applying for citizenship three times, been denied, actually not just denied, but no answer back, I hired an attorney, and we're supposed to try to follow up. And lo and behold, like about a month ago, 2 months ago, 5 o'clock in the morning, they came and picked me up and threw me in. So after a day in 26 Plaza, then moved to New Jersey for 2 weeks, but had my lawyer. I was lucky, actually. I've been finally got me out, but shocked my lawyer as well. That's what's happened, because I followed every procedure. But yes, eyes do exist.
And did they just let you out eventually?
No, it's not. Oh, no. It's my attorney, of course, have to follow up and trace him what's happened. Eventually, what's happened is about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, they're trying to reach me for a court date, and I already moved. Although I have followed with a lawyer, followed a change of address, for some reason, the immigration didn't register. So they got a claim against me on absentia for deportation. So that's how.
The situation that your caller describes is very typical. Something that is important to keep in mind is that many of the people who are picked up through what's called the criminal alien program are not criminals. In fact, most of the people who are picked up through the criminal alien program are not criminals, according to ICE. It's like 58% are not criminals. The same problem exists in the 287G program, the program where law enforcement in local communities is implementing immigration laws. And in according to ICE's data, in 2008, 72% of the people they arrested were not criminals.
We have another caller who was picked up by ICE. Gurarit, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to first of all congratulate Jacqueline for writing this book. I was picked up in 2005. I was on an H-1B visa, and I was being abused by my employer. And the day I complained of the abuse, they fired me. And in 2 weeks, the immigration people, the ICE people, they picked me up and took me to York County Prison in Pennsylvania, where I stayed for over 4 months. I have an MBA from Rutgers, a master's from NYU. And
what were you? What were they charged? Did they tell you you were charged with something?
Well, if you are on an H-1B visa and your employer fires you, he or she has the right to revoke the visa. So automatically the visa is revoked and I am out of the status.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I was told by the lawyers that I have 30 days to look for a new job and I'll be able to transfer my visa, which I tried to do. But apparently that was not correct. So since I was out of status, I was put under removal conditions, which I'm still on.
But aren't you married to an American?
It was a prison. They treated us like cockroaches and ants. There were 80 people in a room meant for 10 people, and there was one bathroom.
Right, Sorry, just to expand on this point, the treatment that your caller describes is typical, and the ICE agents are very callous and even cruel to the people who are being held there. They ignore them. They won't make eye contact. If a question's asked, people will be ignored. When they talk to me about the people they held that they hold or move around, they call them bodies. They'll say, we had, two bodies that we moved. And first you're thinking, wow, like these people might not be alive. And then it turns out, no, that's just what they call people.
Now, you were married to an American citizen, weren't you?
Well, so when I was released on a bail, I got married to a U.S. citizen. She was also a lawyer. And we fought our case for 3 years. My marriage went downhill because of the immigration problems. Despite being a professional, I didn't get any authorization to get employment. We kept on visiting the court. We kept on visiting the immigration offices in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And we were told that the case is pending. I visited the senator's office, both in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, the congressman back in President Bush's administration, and nothing happened. I live in an apartment, and I tell my friends and family that half of my apartment is full of the immigration files, and I'm still nothing but a file for this country.
That's a very poignant way to put it. There's another way to think about this problem is that our government spends twice as much on immigration law enforcement, ICE and the Customs and Border Protection, than it does on the administration of immigrant status and citizenship laws. So that there's a real one of the reasons your caller would get picked up is because of the lack of responsiveness in the administrative agency that should be adjudicating his claim, and that leads to these kinds of questions and problems.
Thank you so much for calling us. You wrote another piece, an article for The Nation's website about the ISIS arrest tactics. I was thinking about the upcoming census and the fact that you revealed that ICE members impersonate postal workers and Mormon missionaries sometimes in the process of arresting people. Why would they, just to gain access?
I didn't write that they impersonate postal workers. Maybe they do, but that's not something that I personally came across. I have seen cases where they impersonate OSHA inspectors and accounts of impersonating Mormon missionaries and insurance inspectors. And even the case I found the most disturbing was impersonating an immigrant's attorney. And in that particular operation, the agent called the attorney, ascertained her address, and then called her client and arranged for him to meet there under the pretense of calling on behalf of the attorney. And when the client arrived, there were these two ICE agents waiting, and they arrested him there.
Is that legal to impersonate somebody?
It's legal for federal agents to impersonate certain individuals under our law. And they're called ruse operations. Before going into the parts that are illegal, I want to emphasize that using these kinds of ruse operations may be legal, but we have to think about whether it's good policy and when these kinds of tactics should be used. There should be some kind of balancing. Maybe if you're trying to get Osama bin Laden, it's okay to impersonate, say, a postal worker. But if you're just trying to, do a little survey and see who's in what neighborhoods and what their legal status is, the kind of distrust and corrosive effects it has on a community needs to be balanced against the outcome.
And we talk about this, the reason I mentioned census is because then people won't allow the census takers in, they lie, and we don't really know who's living here.
That's right. And, the response that I got from ICE is really unsettling because I asked them, is it consistent with ICE policy for agents to impersonate religious workers? And the only legally correct answer to that question is no. And instead of giving that response, they explained in detail how it would be consistent with their ruse operations for ICE agents to impersonate religious workers.
How would someone who supports these policies, Lou Dobbs, for example, respond to your views? I wonder if you think that the failed terrorist attack on the American Airlines plane on Christmas Day would lead many Americans to fully support what you're arguing against here?
I think you have to spell that out a little more because I mean, don't
do you
understand
think that
why.
I think right now Americans are probably more concerned about a possible terrorist attack mm-hmm. than they are about abuses of civil rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think there's a big question about what most Americans are concerned about. I think there's been surveys that show that most Americans are concerned about not having to wait in long lines at airports also. And it's not clear
to me. I'm past
to
being annoyed about taking off my shoes.
So I think that's one question. It's not clear to me that picking up, you know, people who have cognitive disabilities or who have problems with their work status makes the country safer. In fact, you could make the argument that if the Department of Homeland Security were more focused on actual prevention of, you know, people going into airplanes with, you know, explosives than they were on doing these kinds of operations where they're impersonating Mormons, maybe that would make us more secure.
Where would you like to see them detain people who are they're still unsure about?
I'm really glad you asked that question. So there's a lot of ways that you can that the government can handle people who have cases before the government. And one model for this is the IRS. So the IRS, like Immigration Services, is an administrative body. If you break the tax law, you don't just go to a tax jail. If you're accused, you go through an administrative process. And while that process is playing out, you're not put in prison. Even after that process is being played out, you may just compensate in a way that has to do with money, but you wouldn't serve time. And so that's one point. The second point is that a lot of immigrant rights advocates are supporting measures that would either allow people out on bond or that would, especially people who have longstanding ties to the community. Most of the people who are held in the detention centers, the vast majority, are not people who were just picked up, you know, because they crossed the border 2 days ago. They're people who have very deep, extensive ties in the community. And that's why they're risking, you know, waiting all this time in the detention center in order to assert their legal status. So these are the kinds of people who you can count on showing up for their hearings and, you know, really following through on the process. And then the final alternative that's been suggested are ankle bracelets, where you can have some kind of monitoring technology that would be short of actually incarcerating people.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Jacqueline Stevens. Her article, America's Secret Ice Castles, is in the current issue of The Nation. There are also other articles that can be accessed on The Nation's website. Her book is States Without Nations, Citizenship for Mortals, which is published by Columbia University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you.